Testing. Good afternoon or good morning. If everybody's joining us today, we'll be taking up this week's parsha, the dreams of Paro and Joseph's interpretations. We'll stop momentarily. We're just going to go through a brief audio check to make sure that you're all picking up the audio feed properly. Once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm that the audio feed is being sent out. And again, we'll start just in about 1 minute. And we'll have pauses intermittently if you'd like to ask questions or if you'd like to pose possible answers. And you can use the chat feature at the bottom of the screen just to type in your question or your response at that time. And we just ask that you hold off on any other comments or other typing just to make sure that we don't overlook any of the questions. Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, Doug. How you doing there?
Pretty good.
Good morning.
Good morning there.
Did somebody else just joined the call?
Yeah, it's me. Good
hey,
morning.
Josh, how are you?
I did pretty good.
Good.
How you doing, Josh?
Good. How are you?
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank God. Doing good. Okay. All right, so let's start. So I'm going to take up the dreams of Paro, and but primarily Joseph's interpretations of those dreams. So let's just go through the story briefly. So we're in this week's Torah reading, which is Miketz, and it says that at the end of 2 years, that Paro had a dream, and he was standing on the Nile, on the river. And from the Nile, there ascended 7 cows that were very beautiful of appearance and healthy, healthy of flesh, and they were grazing. And behold, 7 other cows had also ascended from the Nile. Let's just make sure. Are they ascending from the Nile? Yes, from the Nile. And the ones that came up afterwards, the second set of the 7 cows, were very lean, of poor visual quality. And they stood next to the other cows. They were on the edge of the Nile. And the thin, emaciated cows had swallowed the very healthy cows. And Paro woke. Paro then went back to sleep. And we're in Genesis 41, right at the beginning. Paro then went back to sleep a second time. And behold, there were 7 stalks of grain that had risen up. And they were very healthy and very good to look at. And behold, 7 other stalks had risen up, and they were blasted by the east wind, and they were very depleted. And again, those 7 latter stalks had swallowed up the healthy ones. And the Paro woke up, and behold, it was a dream. So he had 2 dreams. And it was in the morning that his soul was like disturbing him. And he sent all the astrologers of Egypt and all of his wise men to tell Paro his dream. But there was nobody that Paro accepted their interpretation from. And as Rashi mentions, that they said that you're going to have 7 daughters and then you'll bury 7 daughters. They were latching on to the number of 7 and also the duplicated quality of both healthy and emaciated. By the cows and also by the stalks of grain. Then all of a sudden, the wine steward spoke up, And he told Paro, my sins I will mention to you today. Because he was now going to recall the fact that he was put into prison because a fly was found in the drink, if you remember from the previous section of the Torah. And he eventually was restored to his position, to his post. And the wine steward goes on and now tells Paro, this is Genesis 41:10, and he says to Paro that Paro was angry at his servant, meaning myself, and you placed me in prison. The officer of the executions, myself and also the baker, the head baker. And we both dreamt the dream that night, myself and him, in accordance with the interpretation we dreamt. Interesting statement, which the commentaries say, the rabbis say, that since Joseph's interpretation was so good, it seemed that the interpretation was being followed by the actual dream. Normally, it's the dream that you have, and then the interpretation latches onto it, but this is to praise Joseph that it seemed to be just the reverse because his interpretation was so pristine. And he says, but there was with us this young Hebrew servant to the officer of the executions of Paro, and he told us our dreams, each one of us according to our dreams, he interpreted. And it was like he interpreted to us that it came to be. I was restored to my post, and the head baker was hung, just like Joseph had interpreted. So when Paro heard this, he sent for Joseph, and they took him from the pit, and they shaved him, and cleaned him, and dressed him, and they brought Joseph now to Paro. And Paro said to Joseph, I had a dream, and I cannot find anybody to interpret it for me. And I've heard that you listened to a dream to interpret it. And Joseph said, it's aside from me. God will answer the peace of Paro. And Paro told Joseph, in my dream I saw standing on the edges of the Nile, and behold, there were the seven healthy cows that came up, and they grazed on the side, and seven lean cows came up afterwards. They were very poor quality, exceedingly, and very thin. And I've never seen any cows like these in all the land of Egypt, for being of such poor quality. And those thin cows, those poor quality cows, they swallowed up the first cows that were healthy. And they came inside them, and you couldn't even tell, because their appearance was just as poor as it was beforehand. And then I woke up. And then again, I saw in my dream, and there were seven stalks that had risen up, and they were full and beautiful. And they came up on one branch. And then, behold, there were seven other stalks that were blasted by the wind, by the east wind, and they were very poor quality. And those seven poor quality stalks had swallowed up the very healthy stalks. And I've told these over to my astrologers, but nobody can explain them to me. So again, Paro didn't accept that interpretation of the astrologers, that you can have seven daughters and you'll bury seven daughters. So let's see what Joseph says. So Joseph now responds. Now we're in verse 25. And Joseph says to Paro, the dream of Paro is one. That which God plans to do, he has told Paro. The seven cows that are good, and the seven stalks, the seven cows of good appearance are 7 years. And the seven stalks that were good appearance also means 7 years. The dream of Paro is one. Right, he says, behold, the dream is one. Right, so he repeats that. And then he says, the seven cows that were lean and of evil appearance that came up afterwards are also 7 years. And the seven stalks that were blasted by the east wind are very withered. That means to say that there will be 7 years of famine. All right, there's a question there. Now look what Joseph says. But Joseph says, this is the matter which I have told Paro. That which God plans to do, he has shown Paro. All right, so midstream in his interpretation, because he hasn't finished the interpretation yet, he didn't talk about the good years, the years of plenty yet. He only spoke about one thing, that the seven the seven withered stalks are 7 years of famine. So it's important to note that even though he has not concluded his interpretation, he says to Paro, in other words, he says in verse 28, that's the matter which I have told Paro, which God plans to do, he has shown Paro. Then he continues with his interpretation. Right, so you see there's an interruption there. You see that?
Yeah.
Okay. So then he continues, and he says now in 29, behold, there will be 7 years that will come of great sustenance in all the land of Egypt, and then there will arise 7 years of famine after them, and there will be forgotten all the years of plenty in Egypt, and the famine will consume the land, and there will not be known the years of plenty because of the famine, because it will be greatly oppressive. Then he says in 32, and now regarding the duplication of the dreams to Paro, why it would happen twice? Because the matter is already imminent from God, and he will hasten it that it will happen immediately. Okay, so that's the end of Joseph's interpretations. Now, what does Joseph say? He says, now Paro should seek for himself a man who is wise and understanding and place him on the land of Egypt. And you should portion the land in the, he says what, one second. Give me one second. He says, that's in 34, says that he should appoint people of position over the land. They should oversee the land. And this way it will prepare Egypt for the years of abundance, the years of the plenty. And then he goes on in 35, he says, let them gather all the food of those approaching good years, and let them gather all the grain under Paro's hand, and there should be food in the cities, and they should safeguard it. And then that will act as a reserve for the land against the years of famine, which will befall the land of Egypt. And this way, the land won't perish during the famine. And now in verse 37, so Paro, it says, the matter appeared good in Paro's eyes, and the eyes of all his servants, and Paro said to his servants, can we find another like him, meaning Joseph? A man in whom is the spirit of God? And Paro said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there can be no one as discerning and as wise as you. So he was taken back by this great interpretation and the plan, too. You will be in charge of my palace, and by your command, all the people will be sustained, and I will only outrank you. I'll only be superior to you in the throne. And Paro said to Joseph, see that I place you in charge of all the land of Egypt. And Paro removed his ring from his hand, he put it on Joseph's hand. And then he dressed him in garments of fine linen and placed a gold chain on his neck. And he had him ride the second royal chariot, and they proclaimed before him Avrech. And Avrech, according to Unglis, means that he's father of Paro. So therefore, Paro appointed Joseph over the land of Egypt. Okay. All right, so that's the story. And now we have to go to the questions. Now let's go to the questions. Now, the first thing I think we have to lay down here is that we do not see, and we see that everything that Joseph said came true. But we don't see that God gave this information to Joseph In fact, it seems to be an immediate response after Joseph hears Paro's dreams, and he gives the interpretation, which supports the fact that there was no prophecy over here. So how did Joseph know what these dreams meant? And why did Paro enjoy his interpretation any better than the interpretation of the Egyptian astrologers? I mean, what was the real qualitative difference? The Egyptian astrologer said the seven means you can have seven daughters. And the fact that there were also seven lean cows and seven lean stalks, that means you're going to bury them. That's a negative quality. So Paro said you're going to have 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. So they're both addressing seven. They're both talking about there's going to be something good. Astrologer says you're going to have seven daughters. Joseph says you can have 7 years of plenty. And they both talked about something subsequently which would be evil. The astrologer says that you're going to bury these daughters. They're all going to pass away. And Joseph says it's going to be 7 years of famine after the plenty. So why was Paro so much more impressed with Joseph than the astrologers? All right, that's the first question. And keeping in mind that we don't see in the verses that, you know, this was revealed to him by God. Okay. That's one question. Now, if Joseph did not receive any prophecy, so the question is going to be, well, how did he know this? How was he able to foretell exactly what was going to take place? And was this the first time Joseph was successful at the forecasting future events based on dreams? I mean, what happened in the previous Torah portion with the wine steward and the baker?
Well, he interpreted dreams there as well.
Exactly. And there again, it seems to be in one conversation. He listens to the wine steward and the baker, and he responds, and there's no prophecy that he gets to interpret it. So this is not the first time. It's actually not the second time that he had dreams. When did Joseph have dreams even before the wine steward and the baker? When did he deal with dreams?
When he was really young with his brothers, about that he would rule over his brothers.
Right, exactly. So this is the third instance of dreams with Joseph. So in general, just that alone, what is going on? That dream seems to be a recurring phenomena in connection with Joseph. Okay. So now, to get the answers, what do we have to do? How do we figure out the answers to the question? What always has to be our first step?
Well, when you have a multitude of questions, wouldn't you try to answer one that seems the easiest first in order to get a little slight thread pulled off the tapestry?
Okay. And what would be our first step to do that?
Identify which question is the easiest one to answer.
Okay, and then what would be the next step after that?
Postulate an answer.
Very good. Okay, from where will we derive clues to the answer? And let me just mention it. Jerry in Maryland, welcome to the class. Jerry is writing, Joseph's interpretation leads to a method of control or a solution to a problem. The astrologer's interpretation does not. It is true, Jerry, that Joseph did offer a solution. However, I think we still have to separate the solution from the interpretation. Because had the astrologers done the same and said you're going to have seven daughters, you're going to bury seven daughters, so I don't think a solution to the problem that they might have presented would necessarily convince Paro of the actual dream explanation. And Dina in Atlanta, welcome, is writing, Dina's writing that the first step should be to look at Rashi, Ramban, etc. Well, Dina, I would ask you, if Rashi and Ramban, which we see they write, you know, extensively, they had many questions, but before there was a Rashi and Ramban commentary, what did Rashi and Ramban do? And I see that Marilyn in Montreal is not picking up the sound. Maybe somebody could type on screen that she should use, I think she has to be using Internet Explorer, or she has to be using Windows Media. Okay, maybe someone wants to just write that on the screen for her. Okay. And Jerry's just
maybe
writing.
Maybe the answer is next to the question, right?
Right, very good. Like Josh is saying, the answer, choose vaso, betsidoso, that the answer is next to the question. And Jerry, you're asking, how are you going to avoid bearing seven daughters? Well, if he doesn't marry, if he doesn't have children, he'll avoid that. But I'm just saying that the interpretation itself has to be separate from the solution. So I don't necessarily think that Paro bought into Joseph's interpretations because of a solution. I think there had to be, and I'll prove it to you from the verses, that Joseph knew that Paro bought his explanation before the solution. All right, and Josh is saying that's the first step. So the answer, you know, Doug and Dina and Jerry, the first step, and I agree, Doug, you do have to locate an initial question to make some inroads, or as you said, to pull a thread off a tapestry. But the answer I was looking for is that we go back to the verses. We have to keep in mind that, you know, sometimes we have the tendency, and, you know, I've seen this plenty of times where, you know, a couple of people are conversing in Torah. One has a question, and the other one gives a knee-jerk reaction, like how did Joseph know the dreams? Oh, well, somebody says as a response, God told him. Well, why say that if you don't have that in the text? And we have to be very appreciative that the Torah study is actually that. We study the Torah. We study the words. So that's really what the answer is going to be. That's how God designed the Torah, in a way that the very verses that give us the questions also can reveal the answers. But we have to be sensitive to what the verses are saying. And remember, you know, Moses wrote down all the verses, but it was verbatim from what God told him. So that means God orchestrated and designed every single verse we have in the Torah, every single word. So it's tremendous wisdom here. If we keep that attitude at the forefront, I think we'll be much more sensitive to and much more appreciative of how much depth there is to each one of these verses. Okay? Okay, and Jerry, you're asking, well, why did maybe Paro accepted Joseph because of the butler's recommendation of Joseph as being good with dreams? I think Paro still would look at the explanation itself, regardless of any type of testimonial that the butler might have given him. Let's look and see what if we could find a clue in the verses.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
So I may be relying too heavily on the English translation here, but in verse 8, let's see, let me get to the right verse 8. It says that in the morning his spirit was agitated, so he sent and summoned all the necromancers of Egypt, all the wise men. But Pharaoh related his dream to them. Now, dream is singular. But none could interpret them for Pharaoh, and the word them is plural, which might suggest that when you ask the question, well, why did he prefer Joseph's interpretation over theirs, they could give an explanation, but he related his total dream, which was in two parts, and they were not able to give an explanation of why he had two, whereas Joseph was.
Okay, very good. That's very good detection. Right, and I'll support what you're saying. And I agree 100% that is a quality that Paro saw in Joseph's interpretation, which he did not see in the astrologers. but now I'll prove it to you. Unless you want to take a moment and see if you can prove it yourself. Prove to me your case that Paro was more impressed with, or I should say Paro was impressed with Joseph and was not impressed at all with the astrologers. And it was based on duplication. Prove that to me from the verses.
Okay, give me a second.
Time? Okay.
Well, might be a stretch, but in verse 37, it says, the matter appeared good in Pharaoh's eyes and in the eyes of all his servants.
Well, wasn't that about the appointment of Joseph, not about the interpretation?
Isn't that the first response that we hear from Pharaoh or see from Pharaoh after the interpretation is given?
It seems to be a response to Joseph's plan to sustain the land, not to the interpretation.
But there's no other...
It's something to do with verse 28. Something... Right?
You tell me.
That's where it seems.
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean it has something to do with...
What's that?
What do you mean? What aspect of verse 28?
Well, it seems, you know, like you pointed out earlier, it seems kind of odd that he interrupts his interpretation, seemingly, to say, you know, that it's a matter that I've spoken to Pharaoh. And then he says, you know, what God is about to do, he has shown to Pharaoh.
Well, that wouldn't be a support for Doug's claim that what Paro saw in Joseph's interpretation was duplication, which he didn't see in the astrologers. That doesn't mention anything about the duplication, does it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. I mean, that verse is, as I mentioned, seems like an interruption. This is the matter which I spoke to Paro. That which God is going to do, he has shown Paro. That, what does that show you about? And Joseph at that point did not complete his interpretation yet. So what is he saying, in other words? Why is he stopping midstream in his interpretation and making this statement in 28? That is a matter which I told Paro. What God is going to do, he has shown to Paro.
Like in 16, you know, he says, that is beyond me. It's God who will respond with Pharaoh's welfare.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, like we said, it doesn't seem like there was any pause. I mean, it seems like Joseph just interprets the dream then. Like, not that he received the prophetic... So what does he mean?
Right, if he didn't receive any prophecy, how can he say that God is responding to the peace of Pharaoh? That means to say that Joseph is going to interpret the dream and he understands that it must be from God. That's what that means. When he says that God will answer the peace of Paro, that means that these dreams are prophetic, Paro, but I did not receive any prophecy. I could see from the dream itself it's prophetic, and I'll explain to you the meaning. Jerry is writing, Paro may have accepted Joseph's interpretation because it accorded with his own experience with the cycles of flooding of the Nile. Well, if this was cyclical already, so it's not news then. I mean, this is a common behavior, so if it's nothing new, so I think Paro would not have accepted, Paro did not need Joseph, if that's what it meant. But he's talking about a long range here, 7 years of plenty, then 7 years of famine. Take a look at going back to 28, that Josh, you were just quoting, you have to ask a question. Why does Joseph say midstream in his interpretation, he says, this is the matter which I have told Paro. That which God plans to do, he has shown to you. See, he says that because at this point already he's convinced that he has proved to Paro that this is prophetic. Like if I'm telling you of a story and I tell you certain key evidence that could only place me at the scene, that I could really be an authentic witness, before I finish the whole story, I will stop at that point and I'll say, you see, I was there. How can I know all these facts unless I was there? So that's what Yosef is doing. Joseph is saying over here, Hu hadavar asher dibarti. That's what I see, Paro, I just told you a couple of pieces of information, and you see, that's what I just told you. I told you from the beginning what God is going to do, he has shown to you. Okay, of course you could ask, well, how can he say that to Paro before he even he said this to Paro only after he heard the dreams. But let's take a look again. Since the answers are in the verses, and we're looking for support for Doug's claim that Paro bought Joseph's interpretation, because it wasn't the content per se that pleased him, but it was Joseph said something about the structure of the dream, not the content. It was duplicated. Look at verse 25, and he repeats this. And Joseph said to Paro, after he heard the dreams, the dreams of Paro are one. What God is planning to do, he has told to Paro. The seven cows that are of good appearance, and the seven are 7 years, and the seven stalks that are of good appearance, they are 7 years. It is one dream. What does he repeat? What did Joseph just repeat in verses 25 and 26?
It's all one thing.
Good. He's talking about the duplication. And he's telling Paro, look at the style of your dream, not the content so much. And just to answer Marilyn quickly, what comes first? Does the interpretation in itself make it so with God's help? No. Joseph was merely an observer of the dreams, and he interpreted what God is already planning on doing. He did not in any way cause the events. Meaning God didn't follow Joseph's interpretation. Joseph's interpretations followed the content of the dream. Okay? Okay, Marilyn, I'm glad to see that you have the sound. All right. So now, like you said, Doug, what you see in verses 25 and 26 is that Joseph is impressing on Paro twice, your dreams are really one. He's showing him how the good cows and the good ears is really one concept. And then he also says in 27, the lean cows that are of poor quality. And then the seven emaciated stalks, right? The withered stalks and the emaciated cows. He says, what Sheva Paro's occurs? That refers to 7 years also. And the seven stalks that are withered also, that are 7 years of famine. Interesting also, just parenthetically, you see what he does. He does not go in the order of the events. The first interpretive statement he says, aside from the fact that the seven represents 7 years, he doesn't talk about the 7 years of plenty first. The first thing he says is 7 years of famine. But that came second. Why did Joseph choose to mention that first? He should have mentioned the matters in order. All right, so you see at the end of 27, he says, the seven cows mean this, or 7 years. And 7 years mean, or 7 years, right? That's in 26. He doesn't say what type of years in verse 26. He just says, the seven cows that are good are 7 years. It doesn't say 7 years of anything. And the seven stalks that are of good appearance are 7 years. It's one dream, Paro. But he doesn't say they're plenty. The first thing he reveals is at the end of 27 when he says the withered stalks and the emaciated cows represent 7 years of famine. All right, so let's make sure we come back to that question. But let's go to our original point here. That in 25 and in 26, what Joseph does is he repeats the fact that the dreams are really one. Both dreams that he had about the cows and about the storks are really one dream. Okay? And it's after that that he says to Paro, you see, I've proven to you, Paro, that which God plans to do, he has shown you. Okay. And Marilyn is just asking on screen, how can we be certain that God didn't change events to fit to Joseph's interpretations? We don't see, and there's no basis for that, okay? Joseph is observing, and he's telling what he sees is going to happen. So God is not altering nature. It doesn't, you have no information to tell you that, so we don't see that. And Jerry, you're writing, so Joseph is telling Paro that the dream is God's way of contacting Paro. Yes, yes, Jerry, and we'll go into that. Why? We'll have to go into another question soon. What is this usage of dreams? Okay. But yeah, let's just state the point. So Joseph tells Paro, and Joseph is convinced when he tells Paro that the dream is really, both dreams are really one, Joseph is now convinced that this is something which Paro will agree to. That's why he says, you see, Paro, that's what I told you. What does that mean? So it means, and the commentaries say this, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, they say clearly that when you have two duplicate dreams, so this is unnatural. So the duplication is exactly what Joseph is telling Paro you have to look at. This is not a natural phenomena. Yeah, you can have repetitive dreams night after night, and they're very similar qualities. But you had these dreams, and there was an identical quality to them. It's one dream. So he's telling Paro, this is what I'm telling you, that this is different than anything else. And Paro accepts that. Okay? So that's that, and that's right in the verses. And you see that Ibn Ezra and Ramban, they also say that, you'll say to me, well, the verse, because Joseph goes on and he says in verse 32, he says, and regarding the duplication of the dreams to Paro, because it's imminent. Now, does that contradict me or not?
I don't understand the question.
I'm suggesting that the duplication of the dreams, when Joseph says twice that the dreams of Paro are one, and he says it again, the dreams of Paro is one dream. So when he says that, then he follows it up by saying, you see, Paro, it's like I told you, what God is planning on doing, he has shown you. Meaning he was convinced that the element of duplication would prove to Paro that it was divine origin, that the dreams were of divine origin. All right? So that means duplication means divine origin. But then it says in 32, regarding the duplication of the dreams to Paro, it means that the matter is imminent and God is going to start this right away. The years of plenty are going to start immediately. So that sounds like he's contradicting himself, that the years, that the duplication really means something else. It doesn't mean it's divine, but it means that it's imminent. That's a different quality, right? Meaning, is Joseph saying that the duplication is to show that it's divine origin? Or is he saying the duplication is to show the imminence of the years of plenty and the years of famine? It seems to be, we're not sure, right?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Other than it being imminent, to me, I don't see the connection there. To me, the duplication seems like it would be the severity of it, like drawing, it demands our attention here.
Well, the verse doesn't say that. The verse says in 32, and regarding the duplication to Paro, twice, for the matter is ready, it's prepared, that means it's imminent from God, and he is going to quickly bring this about. So that's the reading of the verse.
So, but if I were Pharaoh, why would I assume that Joseph is correct on that point? In other words, why wouldn't I think, well, maybe it just means intensity, maybe it means I mean, I see that Joseph makes the statement, but he doesn't have anything particular to back that up.
No, he does. What Joseph does, he first lays the groundwork to prove the divine origin of the dream. When he says that the dream of Paro is one, and he repeats that, it's to stress that, Paro, look at that element of your dream. The element of these dreams is that there's this duplication here. That's not natural. And Paro agrees. And Joseph knows that Paro would agree to that. That's what Joseph says right after that. He says, you see, what God is planning on doing is to show it to Paro. Joseph was convinced that that element alone proved the unnatural characteristic of the dream, and it must be from a message from God. You need the commentaries to understand verse 32 when he says that the duplication means imminence. It doesn't mean a duplication, it means a duplication in one night. Meaning there's two things going on here. There's two dreams that are pretty much identical, but then there's the fact that they both occurred in one night. And Joseph says there's something to be derived from both. The fact that there were two identical dreams means that it comes from God. The fact that they occurred in one night, that means that they're happening quickly. That means God is going to bring this about quickly. You see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good point.
Good.
It is, by the way, is this for this particular situation, or is this a deal where if anybody has two duplicate dreams, that means it comes from Hashem?
Yes, it would have to be in all cases. Ibn Ezra says this, I have the source in front of me, but he says this earlier, that the prophecy and all these things, they come in duplication. That is a mark of prophecy. Separate from the whole event here with Joseph. Now, of course, the question is going to be, how did Joseph know all this? Where did he get this knowledge? But at least we understand from the verses themselves. You see how we could learn something, just, you know, amazing ideas from this. Now, let me just pause for a minute. I just want to see if there's any other questions online. I'll just ask everybody to hold off on any questions so I don't miss anything. I'll pause in a few more moments for more questions. But let me just address what's online right now. Marilyn, you're writing that the word of Paser, to interpret, is used seven times and also coincides with the creation narrative. I'm not sure what you mean on that. Jerry, you're writing, there is still the question of the order of the 7 years, the famine first and the plenty first. Good. Let me answer that. See, what Joseph was doing when he mentioned the interpretation of famine, I mean, everybody hears the question? That you notice that when Joseph is interpreting these dreams, he first just brings about the correlation between seven and years, right? With the healthy cows and the healthy stalks. He doesn't say anything about plenty. But then when he talks about the lean cows, the emaciated cows, and the withered stalks, then he introduces the famine interpretation. So that's out of order. He should have first told Paro about the plenty first. Why do you think Joseph interpreted the second element of the dream before the first element? Why does he tell Paro about the famine before he tells them about what really took place first, what was going to take place first, meaning the plenty? What do you say?
Well, if you tell him about the problem first, then you can bring up the first 7 years as the solution to the problem.
Okay. But just in terms of interpreting the dream, okay, I hear you. I'm not going to argue on that.
Yeah, it's not the best answer, though.
Would it be that it would be real easy if he told him about the good years and everything, that you could get sort of focused on that and not see the problem?
Good. Meaning information is presented to a person first, he latches onto first. So now we have to understand, so why didn't Joseph tell him about the events in the correct order? And Jerry, I agree with you that God did not want to tell Paro about the plenty first. But then we'll have to see. No, maybe I don't agree. I think there may be something here that Joseph did on his own.
Well, if he thought that the information that people latch onto first, or that's presented first, is what they latch onto first, then it seems like he would want to present the bad news, so to speak, so that he can get Paro to take action on the good news.
Why? Is it just purely altruism that he wants to help out Paro?
No, I suppose he could be looking then at the whole broader picture and realize that the famine will be extensive enough that it might affect his own family, and this is a good way to affect a solution that will eventually allow him to save his own people.
Good. I think there's another quality, though, too, and that is Joseph is still in prison. He's temporarily out in front of Paro. Perhaps presenting Paro with the negative news first shocks Paro. He sees that Paro has no interpretation. He sees that he's in a fragile situation. He is the leader. So Joseph can effectuate his release from prison by shocking Paro with the bad news first. Like Cal, you were saying, a person will tend to focus on what's presented first. Joseph knew psychology. He was the chief psychologist, as the rabbis say. So he understood, let me present him with that information first. And this will now, presenting myself and presenting my suggestion for a solution, this will now be a good means to get myself out of prison. So that could have been a separate motive, which was a good motive.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Isn't it also a little risky, though? Because what if Paro doesn't like what he's having to say? He could just dismiss it.
Well, nothing Joseph said was negative. It was all positive. And to change the order, that's not something that you get angry about. But Joseph knew that that information would hit Paro between the eyes and would really shatter his confidence. And maybe he saw something of Paro, that this would be a good play right now. And he saw that nobody could interpret it to him. Paro was not buying into these typical interpretations that he had for years from his astrologers. All right. So I think this is my suggestion, why he mentioned the famine first, but the primary point over here is that Joseph is showing the duplication, like Doug pointed out. Okay, and the idea that there is this exact duplication is what he knows Paro will agree to is not typical. It's unnatural. So he stops midstream after he shows Paro that structure of the dream, his duplicate. He shows him it's divine. Then he goes on for the rest. And he says now why he had them both in one night, why the duplication was in one night. There's another element here, that this is going to happen right away. And that's following the character of the two dreams being rushed. Just like they're rushed into one night's sleep, they are rushed to happen. So that was also very plausible. And Joseph was just seeing all this without prophecy. Now, how did Joseph know seven represented famine and plenty? How did he know it had to do with food? Nobody asked that yet. How come? Where did Joseph get this idea that that's what it's dealing with?
Isn't it because of the cows and the grain? I mean, that all has to do with food.
Right, exactly. The cows represent plowing because they didn't eat the animals. They worshipped the animals. But they use them to plow with, and the grain, of course, is what the produce is. Now, I don't have an answer for this, but let's ask it. How did he know that seven correlated to years?
I mean, it could just be that there's, you know, since there's a yearly harvest, like there'd be a yearly grain harvest that happened once a year, then it'd have to be, you know, 7 years.
Well, that's very good. Very good answer. Meaning, since this was dealing with produce, so produce always works it's a cyclical, a yearly cycle. That's very good, Josh. Okay. Now, this basically addresses, let me just see in my notes, 1 second. Now, remind me, we have to come back to the question of why dreams was the method God used over here. But now let's move on to the bigger picture. Let me see if there's any other questions on screen. The strangeness of the dream lies in the seven emaciated cows devouring their healthy ones. Yeah, that was definitely a shocking element. I agree with that, Marilyn. And you're also writing that the Nile is also a symbol of fertility. The cows emerge from the Nile, water, birth, simple. Right, it could also mean that. That's a good point too, Marilyn, that the Nile is really dealing with the irrigative properties of Egypt. That's where, because rain doesn't fall in Egypt, or very little rain of inconsequential use. Chait once mentioned, why was Paro standing on the river? Right, because it says right in the beginning that he was standing on the Nile. Maybe even like standing on it like the Jesus concept of walking on water. But standing on the Nile means that Paro viewed himself as above the Nile. And we all know the Nile was one of the gods of Egypt. And Paro saw himself as above the Nile. And so in the dream itself, you see that he is looking superior, looking at himself superior. Now this could have been, now does he say that he's standing up and repeats it over to Joseph? And he says, yes, he says he was standing on the edge of the river. I was standing on the banks of the river, okay, so not on the water itself, not like a Jesus type of phenomenon. Alright, but he does tell Joseph this. Now, Joseph can very well clue in to the fact that Paro sees himself as being superior to the greatest god, or one of the greatest gods of Egypt, and now he's disturbed with that interpretation. So Joseph could have now looked at that as the opportunity to say later on and bring up the concept of the famine before the plenty, because he knew that would play on the insecurity that Paro tried to present to himself in his own dream, like the rabbis say. You know, there's no dreams that don't have some elements of the person's own nature, meaning there's prophetic elements and there's also personal psychological elements. And Joseph saw that Paro was saying he was standing on the edge of the river, I mean, he was above it. Right? He says, he's standing in the Omed, Al-Safasior. I was standing by the banks of the river. That's what he tells him that. So I'm just saying this could be another clue to Joseph to understand that he can utilize Paro's insecurity. All right. And that would help him get out of the prison. But now, okay, so one more dream. One more question that we have just before we move on to a bigger question I'm going to ask you is that we have to come back to why dreams were used. All right? So you remind me just to come back to that. But now let's ask a broader question. I mentioned at the beginning that this was not the first time that Joseph had dreams, and we all know that. What can we say about that? What can we say about the fact that God gave Joseph those dreams about all the sheaves bowing down to his sheaf, and all the 11 stars and the sun and moon were bowing down to him? Maybe we could now extend this discussion to address that, and also the dreams of the baker and the wine steward. And hopefully we could finally answer, how did Joseph get to be such a great dream interpreter?
And it seems like you have this element of duplication in all three cases.
Very good. Excellent. You have duplication by Joseph's dreams when he was 17, when he was still at home with his brothers, and you had duplication with the wine steward and the baker.
Yeah.
Okay, what's...
I was just looking back at that one, was in 48. It says they said to him, "We dreamt the dream." Maybe I'm missing something, but it seems like they should say we dreamt dreams. They say it's like a singular dream.
Right. That's good.
Yeah, to you.
So, the dreams, though, about the Pharaoh or the baker and the wine steward weren't duplicative.
Well, there was duplication. There were elements of three in both dreams. And they both happened to them the same night. Why didn't they happen on different nights?
Yeah, but you're talking about two different people here, and they weren't dreams that Joseph had.
Agreed. The dreams weren't, you know, the dreams of Paro, Joseph didn't have either. But you do have duplication. I mean, they were not in prison just for one night. They were put in prison for a while, and they could have had these dreams on two different nights. But all of a sudden, on one night, they both had a dream.
I hear what you're saying.
That's actually what Josh is saying. You got to give the man credit. Good observation. I'm just looking at that verse now. Right, you're right. In chapter 40, verse 8, they said to Joseph, "We had a dream, both of us." So they talked about it as being one. They actually sensed it was similar. Okay. See, I think that there's something very amazing going on here. And that is as follows. That there's a plan. That God has a plan for the world at that time. He initially gives dreams to Joseph. God knows the response of the brothers. God knows this is now going to cause, and it wasn't a stumbling block. God didn't cause the brothers to respond this way, but the dreams were given to Joseph, and for a reason. And there were two dreams. I believe like this, that in order to bring out the greater good for those people, those Hebrews, they were initially going to go down, there's going to be a famine, and to save them from the famine, and eventually bring them all into Egypt until the ultimate exodus, until they finally got the Torah on Sinai. We could see some of the cogs in this large, this large machine that has like so many gears that we don't know anything about, but we see some hint to how things took place, how they transpired, that the Jews would ultimately get the Torah. Part of that was the dissension of the Jews to Egypt. And this was facilitated through the dreams. The dreams didn't only act as a means that Joseph would now go down and be sold. And then the dreams of the wine steward and the baker caused Joseph now to be mentioned before Paro. And then once he's mentioned before Paro, he's brought before Paro. And then he interprets those dreams and he becomes the viceroy of Egypt. And then the family comes down and he saves them from the famine. And the Jews are there for 200 years until they finally leave and get the Torah. So the Torah is the objective. But you see what God used, that the dreams were not only to effectuate this chain of events, but it's amazing. The dreams, those initial dreams that Joseph got, was the first lesson that God gave to Joseph in order to start training him in dream analysis. He gave the information to Joseph in the way that he starts seeing something. And you're right, Marilyn. Marilyn wrote that he really didn't understand his own dreams when he was younger. But that doesn't mean he didn't stop pondering them. And then when he saw them, what was he doing in prison for 10 years, 11 years, whatever it was? And he sees dreams again. And he's faced with another lesson in dreams. And Joseph must have been asking himself what he did wrong, why was he here, and he thought back to the dreams that he had. Then he thought about the dreams of the butler and so on. And now he started, over all these years, it's my assessment that he became very well versed in understanding dream and the nature, and when something is prophetic and when it's not. This is exactly how he came to be able to answer Paro, and to explain exactly what the dreams meant. Because he was now very much rehearsed. For many, many years, he was rehearsed in the style of dreams, what's prophetic, what's not. And he already saw two major lessons in terms of the duplication in dreams. That's where he got it from. So you see, the very dreams that caused Joseph's brothers to be jealous and brought him down to Egypt were also the very tool by which it initiated Joseph's pondering of the very phenomena of dreams in general. So in one act of giving these two dreams to Joseph, when he was 17 in his parents' house, in his father's house, it set the events in motion that would initially bring down all the Jews to Egypt and then get the Torah later on, but it also trained Joseph in interpretation that he can effectuate this good that God planned for the Jews. Amazing thing. So we tend to look at the stories in the Torah sometimes as just being divorced from each other. Sometimes you have to step back and see, wow, there's something going on here. There's a bigger picture. Okay, let me just stop here, see if there's any questions or comments. Let me just look on screen, see what we're holding. So Marilyn, you're writing, the 6 days of creation parallelisms with these dreams reinforce Paro's self-concept as a godlike figure. I don't agree with that. I don't know that Paro had any type of allegiance to 6 days of creation or so, or even knew about it. Marilyn also writes, Joseph didn't seem to be able to interpret his own dream. Correct, when he was younger. That was the starting point, so he was not versed yet in dreams. Jerry writes that God was giving Joseph practice interpreting dreams all his life. Excellent, Jerry. So you said it before me. Okay. Marilyn writes that Paro's birthday was coming up in 3 days. Anxiety is on the part of the two. Very good. Exactly. That's exactly what Joseph said. And Jerry, you're writing that, and God was giving Joseph practice and seeing repetitive patterns. Interesting. Although God is rarely mentioned in the story, his presence is felt. Okay, and Marilyn writes, he had no confirmation of the rightness of his interpretation until the wine and baker situation, and yet he seemed quite confident interpreting them. That's true. But evidently, Marilyn, you must say that he did have some conviction. That's why he told them what was going to happen. Okay. And then the last thing you're writing, Marilyn, is that Joseph may not have consciously realized that he had no confirmation of his rightness, but the text is certainly suggesting that. I don't see that Joseph questioned the interpretation of the wine steward and the beggar. Okay, Doug, Cal, Josh, whoever else is on the phone. Any questions, any comments before we go further?
Rabbi, the only comment I have is throughout the text, you see among all of the patriarchs and things, this incredible understanding of psychology. It's almost like the book is a psychology study in their dealings with Paro, you know, Abraham, and when he recognized how when he entered the city with his wife and he didn't want them to know she was his wife, so he said that she was his sister. All these things, these stories seem like a theme that they were very knowledgeable about the psychology or very perceptive about people.
Yes, that's for sure. That is for sure. They were definitely, Abraham was able to eradicate himself, emancipate himself from idolatry. He used to serve idols. And he had a very intellectual person, very high intelligence. And the same with his sons, who were trained, and then they on their own developed their ideas about God individually. And that lifestyle, when you're studying the world, it embraces all areas. It's philosophy, God's justice, kindness, psychology. This is not something that we should look at as being just, Freudian as being the forerunners of this field. All wisdom was something which they availed themselves to and studied. So it should not be any surprise, but it should be that we were surprised just the opposite, if they didn't become leaders in those areas too. Because a person who is living a proper life intellectually, he understands all the main categories of knowledge and investigates them all. Because to him, this knowledge gives him increased appreciation and love for the creator of all these sciences. So we read these stories. We see how God puts together the Torah in such a way that the questions are amazing, and the answers are even more amazing. And we just start developing such a higher, you know, increased level of appreciation for what we could find just in the verses themselves. Forget going to the commentaries, just looking at the verses. Again, the commentaries didn't have their own commentaries. So what did they use? Yes, I'm sure that there were transmissions that they had from Sinai, but you also see how they addressed the verses, and like we're doing today. So, and I think looking at the whole span of events from Joseph being a young man at 17 through becoming a viceroy, I think this all fits beautifully. And it's right in the verses. Now, there's one more question we'll take up, unless any of you have a comment or question.
I have a question just about, when Joseph first has his own dream, well, we know that, when a prophet has a, prophetic dream or vision, they know with certainty that it's prophecy. I mean, is that the level that his dreams were on there, or was it just that he sensed there could be something to them, or was he certain that it was?
I don't know. I'm not sure what his sensation of the dreams were. You do have a case when Samuel was still very young, I think 3 years old, when his mother had brought him up to, because that's what she made a wager. And she said that, you give me a child and I'll dedicate him to the temple. So, who was that? I'm trying to remember. Eli was his, Eli was the priest, was a high priest. His father was Elchanan, and his mother, what was the story there? It was Hannah. So she was barren for quite a while, as she made this promise to God, and she finally had a son. And as soon as he was ready, she brought him up to Eli the priest, and he stayed in the temple. And God spoke to him on three times, and the boy did not know yet that this was prophecy. So you do have instances where people didn't know that it was prophecy until they became familiar with the form of it. So I'm not sure how to answer your question regarding Joseph. It could be that he had a sense that it was fortuitous. That's what he told his brothers. He didn't just tell them any dream he had. So I'd be inclined to say that he did sense that this was now fortuitous. I mean, it was prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
And why else would he tell him these dreams as opposed to other ones? Unless you want to say, no, these cater to his ego. Everything's bowing down to him. So then he felt, let me do this. I mean, the rabbis do say that he used to, the Torah says that he brought evil words about his brothers. He would, tattle on his brothers to his father. So he did have a certain amount of ego that was not in full control. So maybe that's why he said these dreams. And you don't have to say that they were necessarily because he sensed that they were prophetic. Maybe he just fed his own ego. I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But let's answer one more question. Unless there's any other questions or comments anybody has, I'll wait. Okay. The one last question we had is this phenomena of dreams in general, that God uses this as a means. See, I think this is another very, very amazing idea. And that is that a dream, by definition, requires interpretation. And perhaps God uses dreams with the prophets, as a way of prophecy, and things are concealed the same way when God gives us the Torah. Like, for example, this very story, there are things that are concealed until we dig into it. And that's to teach the identical lesson. Dreams and the concealment of ideas in the Torah, it mirrors one pattern, and that is that when God gives information, the lesson is that we have to dig into it. Our minds can't immediately penetrate the depths of God's knowledge. We can never penetrate the depths of God's knowledge. But dream is an example of how something is seen, but there's something below the surface. And the same is the case with the God's words written in the Torah. So perhaps that is why dreams are being used when God reveals information. because man has to appreciate that he has to look into it. And dream teaches that lesson. You have to look into this matter. The wisdom of God is, the wisdom of God is amazingly deep. As Rabbi Chait quoted this past week, Mishpatecha Tahom Rabba, that your statutes are exceedingly deep. And in order to impress this upon a person, dreams is a perfect analogy to the method by which we first see information and then we have to unravel it. Because at first glance, or even the tenth glance, we can't know what the real message is. Because you're talking about God's knowledge. And our knowledge is only increased through thought. That's why we have an intellect. That we take information and then we think into it. We don't just give knee-jerk reactions. We don't assume that whatever we see on the surface is exactly, the be-all and end-all to everything. Since we're talking about the universe...
It says that regarding Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem spoke to him directly. Is that so? You would seem like he wasn't required to engage in the deep thought as somebody who would have like a dream that he has to analyze.
Right, he was a much closer level to God. You're right. That's a very good point. But nonetheless, when he asked God to see God's true nature, God says you can't know that while you're alive. So even Moses that. He pierced 49 out of 50 curtains that are like veils between man and God. I mean, he came so close, but there's still one curtain he couldn't go through.
Can you say, on the other hand, that maybe Moshe Rabbeinu was in a level where he automatically thought that way? He wouldn't need to, exert any effort to, like, naturally he thought in, like, very analytically, and he was very intelligent, so it was kind of like speaking to him directly.
In which case?
I guess instead of, can you interpret it as instead of like saying that God just told Moshe Rabbeinu the ideas, that really Moshe Rabbeinu was on such a level that he can just, and even though he was given to him in like deep, complicated, hints, that Moshe Rabbeinu could automatically understand them?
I'm not sure how immediate it was. I can't answer that. I don't know. Man is still not God, no matter how great man is. I would still tend to think it still had to be comprehension, that Moses himself could still reach new levels. But definitely, like you're saying, he was on an unparalleled level. And that's something for sure. That's one of the 13 principles that Maimonides writes. The prophecy of Moses was different than all other prophets. And Marilyn is making a very interesting statement online. She's saying that, can we make a conclusion between the word chalom, dream, and lechem, bread, since the same three letters are used? Lechem plays a major part in all of this. I'm not sure, Marilyn, how lechem plays a major part, but I know that Maimonides does talk about how when there's prophecies and the hidden style of prophecy sometimes is where an object is seen, but that object has letters that have to be inverted or rearranged in order to spell out the true prophecy. Okay. But it is interesting, there is a parallel that just like, bread is something which is derived from a previous state of dough, so there has to be a maturation of the original product, so dreams also. There has to be a maturation of the original dream. There has to be an interpretation. Interesting observation. Okay. All right, but it, just to get back to the point, that it is an amazing phenomena that the dreams are a phenomena that have a surface information, there's the manifest content, and then there's a latent content, like Freud would talk about, the hidden content. So that is the same way that the Torah works. Again, man can't grasp information as it is. He has to think into it. He has to understand the verses, but God gave us the keys to unraveling the ideas by the style of the written words, the written verses. Okay. Okay, and Marilyn, you're saying about... All right, I'll have to think about that, Marilyn, about the bread. I'll have to think about that. Interesting observation. All right, so... okay, I think that's everything I wanted to cover. Any other questions or comments?
I think we're good, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay. All right, very good. Okay, so I guess we're going to pick up on Sunday. We'll continue. Regular class, everybody else is invited. We do a Sunday class, 11:15 New York time. So if anyone wants to join us, we will continue then. And until then, I wish everybody a good day, a nice weekend. Good Shabbos to everybody, and we'll pick up then.
All right, Rabbi, thanks. Good Shabbos to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Pat. Okay, my pleasure. Okay, so that'll wrap it up for today. We'll put the class online shortly. If anybody missed any part of it, you'll be able to hear it in its entirety. We place these classes on the audio link. And until the next class, wish everybody a good day. Nice Shabbos, good weekend, happy Hanukkah, and we'll speak to you soon. Take care.